This program is supported by grants from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. It's 10:06 on the Central Coast of California. Time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This morning on Geek Speak, we're talking with Ron Austin about data recovery. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversations. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll be giving out those numbers again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, John Tracy, and Dee Dee Hubbard. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey.
Before we start a discussion about data recovery, the geek news.
A federal appeals court panel has struck down a law that restricted children's access to violent video games, basically calling them free speech under protection. So what happened was the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled Tuesday that a St. Louis County, Missouri ordinance that banned the rental and sale of graphically violent video games to minors violates free speech rights. The judges in what they wrote was, and I quote, "We see no reason why pictures, graphic design, concept art, sounds, music, stories, and narrative present in video games are not entitled to similar protection. The mere fact that they appear in a novel medium is of no legal consequence. Whether we believe the advent of violent video games adds anything to the value of society is irrelevant. Guided by the First Amendment, we are obliged to recognize that they are as much entitled to the protection of free speech as the best of literature." So, very interesting news there.
Mark went up for video games.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting to see, now that these are considered art, you know, how the industry reacts.
All right, also we have in the news... you've probably heard about this already. W32 Bugbear B. I thought we'd bring it up just because it is out there. It is definitely geeky, and it is definitely dangerous.
A new virus.
New virus worm that's exploiting a vulnerability in Microsoft Outlook, Outlook Express, or Internet Explorer. If you have this, there's tools available. You can go up to any of the major antivirus companies, Sophos, Network Associates, Symantec, McAfee.
But doesn't this thing specifically target antivirus software?
Yeah, that's one of the beautiful things about this one. It targets and tries to shut down your existing antivirus software, Zone Alarm, and all the other ones I just named. It's got a huge list of stuff. You can go up to www.sophos.com/virusinfoanalysis.
Okay, John, you've cleared a few machines of this virus, right?
It's nasty.
How do you do it? How do you clear it? How does someone do it themselves?
If you've got antivirus installed, you can get the update for it first. Then you can go, like if you're running McAfee, you can go up to McAfee. There's tools that'll help you.
So it won't stop you from, if you're already infected, your virus protection software might not actually catch it. But if you're already infected, you could get updated your virus
and
listings.
And then there's tools to remove it. One of the things it does is it creates a couple of files. An EXE and a DDL. The EXE allows it to propagate itself via your email. The DDL records all your keystrokes, called the keystroke logging. That's bad because if you go to websites where you need to enter financial information, passwords, secure information.
Theoretically, the machine's taking that. How do you know if you've gotten the virus or not?
Good question.
Your antivirus is supposed to tell you.
Well, yeah. So basically, update your antivirus
definitions
and run them.
Or get the best antivirus out there. That would be OS X, Linux, just basically anything besides Windows.
Well, that
is something I want to point out is that this is a vulnerability in Microsoft. You can go to Microsoft's website, look for Security Bulletin MS-01-027. Inside that is a patch that'll make Explorer and Outlook no longer vulnerable for things like this, which leads us into...
Speaking of patches, Microsoft's looking to change their the way they distribute patches to their customers. Before, there were 8 different ways that they would send patches, either through service packs or through online or through CDs that they'd mail out. They're reducing that to 2 different ways of doing it, and also separating out critical patches from important patches, that being a lot of times you had one that was for Bugbear would be considered a critical, but you may have another patch that isn't really that big of a threat, and anytime you make a patch or change the software, you may introduce a vulnerability or an instability, as it were, something that you were not expecting the program to do, some bug. And so that's why many companies are saying they want some way of getting the more severe patches handled, but being able to roll out the important ones as time permits, when they know that they're under less load or they have time to test it.
Thank you, Miles.
I've got news from Apple. Apple has been meeting with independent labels to try to get wholesale prices on their songs, so you might find your favorite indie artist on iTunes Music Store soon. The same deal for all of the Big 5 is being offered to independent labels like CD Baby, and Apple's doing pretty well with their music store, is selling about 500,000 songs a week.
That's pretty impressive. Dee, you told me some interesting information about iTunes 4. The most recent patch of iTunes disabled a cool feature.
It disabled the ability to share music not just on your local area network, but also all over the internet, just with knowing your friend's IP address.
Okay, so now they've disabled that, so you can't do
right.
IP sharing. You only can do local network sharing.
Because certain programs were exploiting that, and databases were being built up of users who might not have even known that their music was available in this way. But, you know, they put out this patch, and then a couple of days later, it's already been... Hacked again.
Well, we'll keep everybody apprised on the iTunes issue. Miles?
As it turns out, some folks who really like the game Counter-Strike are building a full real-life version of it at Fradley Airfield in England. It's the map Dedust, and it's aimed to be 4 to 5 weekends of paintball goodness. And it's supposed to, they're hoping that they'll have construction done by late this summer.
So... with the earlier article, Life Imitating Art.
Yeah, get me out there.
Dee, what else is Apple doing?
Apple is releasing the new version of Final Cut Pro on June 14th, next week.
And Final Cut Pro is?
It's their video editing software suite. It's a little bit more beefed up than iMovie.
And it is, it's being released next week, version 4?
Version 4.
So look for that. Apple also is dropping its prices on notebooks, actually has dropped the price on notebook, in a move to get the laptop in to be a larger percentage of their market.
This is kind of interesting. A Colorado-based startup called Cornice has developed a 1.5 gigabyte, 1-inch diameter hard drive. Now, a lot of people do these sorts of things, but these guys already have a slew of customers that are going to be using this thing.
How big is this thing?
It's about 1 inch in diameter and is very thin, so it can enable much smaller devices. And so
think of a platter a little bit bigger than a quarter.
Yeah, kind of like that. Maybe about that size. Samsung's going to be releasing a digital video camera in August that will have this Cornice drive in it, and 12 other companies have plans to release products, including RCA Thompson, Rio, which is Creative Labs MP3 player, and five other manufacturers.
Now, this is interesting because this company is a startup in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah, well, you know, that's the thing. People are wondering, how did they get these kind of contracts?
No kidding.
New technology, new startup. Turns out that engineers and executives from Maxtor, Seagate, and Quantum, and other hard drive manufacturers comprise this company.
Okay, so this is it.
So they knew who was doing what, mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I think is going to happen, you can buy these MP3 players now with maybe 128, 256 megs built into them with some sort of compact flash or other mm-hmm. type of, you know, removable storage device. I think we're going to start seeing these products with 1.5 gigabytes built into them. And then you can add...
And maybe add a card as well.
Add a card later on.
Yeah, and to put into perspective, these things are supposed to be less than $100, like that.
Right.
10 years ago, 1.5 gigabyte hard drives were full height. In other words, 5 1/4 inches and, what was that, like 4 inches tall, and a minimum of $1,500.
So prices drop, size drops. We see it all the time.
So, yeah, quantities of 10,000, these things sell for $65, and they're aiming for $50, whereas the micro drives of the same size sell for about $219. So, and also these things contain 1/3 the moving parts.
And less screws even.
Less screws, and they can survive a drop from about a meter.
Which might be convenient for our next topic. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Miles, Didi, John, and Sean. Data recovery is the process of getting data off a hard drive or some other storage media when the media has become unreachable or unreadable. It is essential that you do regular backups of your data because your media will eventually fail. It's only a matter of time. As Sean likes to say, there are two types of hard drives, those that have failed and those that will fail. Ron Austin is the Vice President of Marketing and Business Development at Action Front Data Recovery Labs and joins us now from Toronto via phone. Hello, Ron, and welcome to GeekSpeak. Or does he join us from phone? Ron, are you there? All right, we're going to take a second to talk more about hard drive recovery. In general, how do you know when you need hard drive recovery, Sean?
Well, it's better to be prepared before you actually know whether you need it or not. All I can say is back your data up, your most important data. Now, your applications, those usually come on software disks, so you don't really need to worry about backing your applications up so much. But the data that you created with those applications could be very important to you or not. The stuff that is, you want to back it up on CD or some other device, but not necessarily another hard drive. Because once a hard drive fails, you're not going to get access to that data anymore, and recovery is a very expensive and time-consuming option.
And some clues as to what you might need to back up, obviously any document you've created, but also make sure you get your mail preferences, which contain your address book, bookmarks, things like that,
and
because a lot of times that's overlooked.
Next week on GeekSpeak, we'll be covering backup in more detail. Ron, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, thank you, Lyle.
Thank you, Ron Austin, for joining us. Ron, you work for Action Front. People can learn about Action Front at actionfront.com. You have an office. Well, tell us a little bit about where you are. You're located in Toronto.
Yeah, I'm speaking today from Toronto, where our original office was located for the last 14 years. And about 8 years ago, actually, we expanded into the U.S., and our first office was in Santa Clara. We now have full-service labs in Santa Clara, Atlanta, and we're opening our third U.S. lab in Chicago. So we're very happy to service the Bay Area and Silicon area from our Santa Clara lab.
All right. Now, I called over there the other day to find you guys, and I spoke to some people there. It looks like you have a clean room there. You have clean desks there. Let's talk a little bit about what the process, when someone decides to take a hard drive to you, what's the first thing that's done?
Well, the first thing we do is we do a kind of a complete analysis of what might be wrong, and in that process, if we can, we take a mirror image of whatever's on the media and get that data onto a stable media, one of our servers or what have you. Sometimes and quite often there's some kind of physical damage to the drive, and we have to effect a temporary repair in order to get that mirror image. The types of things we have to do are from the simplest end of things is swap a circuit board, and sometimes that's enough to get things working again, long enough to get a copy. Other ones can get more complicated. We have to do what we call an internal recovery, and that's when we actually take the HDA chamber, the head disk assembly, as it's called, and we actually open it up. We break the factory seals, and we work directly on the read-write heads, which are located on an arm in there, or on the platters, or some other internal part of the hard drive.
Okay, let's talk a little about the basic structure of the hard drive then. We've got a stack of platters, which are kind of like CD-looking things, except they're magnetic instead of optical.
That's right. I like to think of it as two major components of a drive. You have this PCB, printed circuit board, which is the intelligence of the drive, and that looks much like a motherboard or another circuit board you might find on the inside of the computer. That's right on the top of the drive itself. And then you have the second major part, which I just mentioned, the HDA head drive assembly, and that's the metal casing. And inside that, you have a stack of platters. The platters look very much like, if you take it apart, like a stack of CDs would look. And then interleaved into those platters, you have a series of arms that move back and forth. And on the very end of those arms, you have little tiny read-write heads. And those platters are moving incredibly quickly around. If you remember 33 and 45 RPM records, well, we're talking 7,200 and even 10,000 RPM. So they're going incredibly fast. And the read-write heads are really nanometers above the surface of the platter. And that's so small that a speck of dust is actually bigger than the distance between the head and the platter.
And that's why you need to have a clean room.
That's right, because
you can't have any dust.
Once you have some kind of contamination or damage to those platters, you've got to get it open. You've got to try to deal with that before you can take a read.
Now, I was always under the assumption that the enclosure that has the platters in it and the read heads is actually in a semi-vacuum or is under pressure, under low pressure. But that's not true?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, that's not true. There's usually a little tiny hole that is filtered and does allow for some equalization of pressure. It's not supposed to allow for a lot, but sometimes contamination does get in that way.
So submerging the drive in water is probably not a good thing.
Oh, yeah, you want to keep your drives well away from water. It's interesting that drives that suffer physical damage in, from floods, obviously, they've been in water, but drives that have been through fires are often the most common symptom is water damage again, and that's, of course, because the sprinkler systems or the firefighters have come in and turned the water on.
So, okay, so you're pretty familiar then with recovering data from a drive that's had a lot of water damage.
We do that quite regularly. The truth is that things like fires, floods, and even worse things like explosions and things like that, they garner the most publicity out there, but they're only responsible for about 3% of data loss that people suffer. Really, there's much more mundane factors that are more responsible for it. Device failure is one of them. I think you mentioned that earlier on, that every media will eventually fail. And then the other good old, you were mentioning virus attacks. That's another cause. It's not quite as big as device failure in terms of statistically, the proportion of failures. And then the one that we're all stuck with is human error, and we make a lot of mistakes and often do things that we wish we hadn't done.
So, like Didi recently, one of the geeks here, Didi kick dropped her FireWire drive.
It wasn't necessarily a kick drop, and I don't know if I really should be announcing that on the radio.
But is that a pretty common symptom in the portable?
Oh, sure. I mentioned just how close those heads are to the surface of the platter, and how quickly the platters are spinning. So, if you've got a notebook and it's actually on, like if you're going through airport security these days, they often want you to have it on for some reason. And it's bouncing down the little beltway there, and that's not going to be good for it. Now the manufacturers are getting better and better at building shock resistance into their products, but it can still a little bump there can do something. It's usually less vulnerable if it's turned off, because those arms are supposed to retract to a park zone at the middle of the drive where there's no data stored, and if there's a bounce or something that occurs there, then it's not going to be as big a problem as if the drive is running.
Does that mean that in the park zone it's okay for the head to actually hit the platter?
The head's not on the platter.
It's better if it doesn't, and in fact the drive may not function that well after having that happen. However, our data recovery lab can get data back because the data zones aren't affected.
Okay, but in the parking area, why is it that the drive all of a sudden has, when it's off, for example, when it's in the park sector, why is it that it has better, more tolerances that are less small?
Oh, well, it's really simply a matter of the fact that you're parking the heads in an area where you're not storing data. It's not really that it's more that's better in any way other than if there is if you do touch the platters there, then they're not actually kiboshing any data. An interesting.
But if you drop the drive, you could knock the head loose.
You could knock the head
area.
Loose exactly.
Yeah.
Another thing that happens some of the time is something that's called in the industry stiction, and I don't know if it's in Webster's yet, but it's an accepted word, and it really means when the head gets stuck on the platter, and it's much like if you have two planes of glass and they get stuck together sometime just by the molecules kind of attaching to each other. So that's a problem that's quite prominent that we have to often fix, and people try crazy things to fix stiction. They can tell their drives aren't spinning. So, it's possible the circuit board's gone or the little drive motor, but, stiction's also a common cause of that. So they've read on the Internet that if you knock the drive, it might, break the head free and it'll start spinning again or even twist it suddenly. Well,
that might
fix it, but more likely that's going to do further damage.
So funny, John was talking about this before the show, stiction, and the old MFM drives.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there was some sort of a fluid in the drive that would freeze up, and the recommendation was to drop the drive to kind of free up the head.
Well, yeah, there is a tiny amount of lubrication on the surfaces of the platter, and that's pretty much still in use, although it's a very, very small amount. And the old folklore says twist the drive rapidly with your wrist or knock it or put it in a freezer overnight. And, if you don't value your data, if your data is not that important, you just like to get it back, then sure, go ahead, try that stuff. But if your data is really important, you're really putting it at much further risk if you're going to do something like that.
So the actual Seagate answer to that had to do with a hairdryer and a thermometer. And you slowly start heating it back up until it reaches a certain temperature, and then you try it, and if it's still not, you keep heating it up until it frees the lubricant. It was the lubricants on the spindle of the platter.
Right.
They spin like a record. So, but fortunately, we don't have to deal with that these days, right?
Well, the stiction still occurs on a fairly regular basis, but I wouldn't recommend if you need your data back, I think you should let a professional get at it.
We're talking with Ron, Ron Austin, Vice President of Marketing and Business Development at Action Front Data Recovery Labs. Ron, what's the most? I mean, how do I know if I need to take a drive to a company like you?
Well, I think there could be a number of different symptoms. The simplest one is, your computer was working fine yesterday. You go to reboot it today, and you get what some people refer to as the blue screen of death or whatever. Or it actually boots, but then you go to load your files, and you can't load any of your files. Or you're loading your files, and suddenly you're having, glitches come up. There can be a lot of different causes of those kind of symptoms, but one of the main causes is some kind of corruption, on the media itself. For instance, when the drive ships from the factory, it will have a certain amount of read errors on the media. Virtually every drive does. It would be impossible to make perfect media and get any kind of a commercial yield out of that process. However, what the drive manufacturers do is they write a little bit of firmware and say, okay, if there's bad media, just map it and don't use that part of the drive in the future. Well, sometimes those errors can multiply, and as they do, you get more and more intermittent failures, and eventually the firmware gets swamped and it can't handle that anymore. So if you've got intermittent failures, you should probably stop whatever you're doing, make a backup of your data, and then get a stable media. If you can't get at your data, whether it's because the computer won't boot or that particular file won't load, and you really need it back, our advice is to carefully pack it up. Watch out for electrostatic problems and things like that when you're taking it apart, and ship it into a data recovery lab.
What about software like Hard Drive Mechanic, Easy Recovery, by different companies, by OnTrack and by...
Yeah.
higher ground.
Well, OnTrack is certainly a worthy competitor in the field, and they make software as do quite a few other people. First comment I'd like to make on that is that basically there's no software in the world that will fix a hardware problem. I mean, that's kind of by definition, but a lot of people kind of overlook that. So if your drive is making noises or not spinning or has been through some kind of a physical problem of some kind, then you're not going to make very much progress with software. And in fact, if your drive is even suffering from intermittent problems, playing with that software may actually, make it worse over time because you're still using the drive. A lot of the software that's written for data recovery works right directly on the problem media itself.
Mm-hmm.
And
so like
as far as we're concerned, that's a no-no. We try to get an image of that data onto a stable media, and then we go to work with our own utilities on repairing the actual data itself. So,
But if your hard drive is not failing, it's working, it's firing up, and you've deleted files, or let's say you recently installed an operating system, or you've tried to, and you've lost access to your data on another partition, maybe. A lot of things can happen with the software itself. The drive, not so much the hardware, but on the software side.
Yeah. And you know,
those types of software are good for recovering your data.
Yeah. And I would say yes, with the condition that you have a fair degree of software expertise. You know, those programs can't, some of them are pretty good. But in the hands of a typical user, there's quite a bit of damage they can do as well. So again, if you have a lot of expertise, and depending on how much you value your data or not, you could go ahead and use those programs. If you're more of a casual user or not a power user, not a software expert, and you really have to get your data back, then I don't recommend using them.
Yeah, but the problem is to send a drive in to get it. The data recovered costs a lot of money, and it's not really an option for a consumer.
Well, it really depends. Everybody, you've hit the nail on the head. Everybody really values their data differently. It's a very subjective thing. Some sentimental photographs, they're both priceless and have no, you can't attach a price to them. If you're willing to let go of whatever's there or take a chance on it, then, you know, by all means, try it yourself. A lot of consumers, though, place a high value on their data, and we, I admit that most of the recoveries we do are for businesses, but a very healthy percentage come in from consumers as well.
So you're saying that it'd be most cost-effective to go to you for hard drive data recovery, but my question is rather, if someone were to have data that they in specific that they really wanted to recover, is there any sort of guarantee that you would be able to recover that? Also, since it's a high cost to even try.
Well, that's a really good question, and there's nobody in the world who can guarantee returning data from some kind of damaged media. There is a certain percentage of cases that are simply unrecoverable. If there's severe damage to the platters or something like that, it's just impossible to read data from it. However, I'll just tell you how we work, and not everybody works the same way, not all the data recovery services, but what we do is we give a free evaluation. So you're under no obligation at all if you send the drive to us. I mean, the cost of getting the drive into the shop is about your only financial risk at that point in time. We'll put it through that evaluation process. We'll try to get a read of the drive and get the data onto a stable media, as I mentioned, and then we'll get back to you with a quote. And on simple recoveries on drives, that can be as low as $500, and it can go to $1,500, $2,500, or even higher, depending on the amount of damage. Some people, they have hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of data there. So we really feel like we're putting the power back in the consumer's hands and the business's hands by saying, okay, send us your data, send us your media, we'll give you a definitive quote, and then you can decide how much, your data is worth compared to that quote and whether you want to proceed with it or not.
Ron, we're thoroughly enjoying the conversation with you. I'd like if you would call us back in just a moment. We're going to go into a quick break, but I'd like to get you back to take calls from listeners, if that's okay.
I'd be happy to.
If you could just call us back if I hang up on you, okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Val.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks John, Miles, Sean, and Didi. We're talking with Ron Austin of Action Front Data Recovery. We invite your questions and comments about data recovery questions or problems you might be having. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can also reach us at geeks@geekspeak.org. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services including DSL and spam filters for home and office throughout Santa Cruz County. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301.
This is John Tracy bringing you this week's GeekBit. Power and protection. Did you know one of the most common causes of computer problems is unclean power? Think about it. A computer is comprised of billions of switches and transistors, each one needing power to jump from 0 to 1. If just one of these does not get the power it needs or gets too much power, it can cause freezes, crashes, corrupted data, or even damaged hardware. So what can you do? The simplest and cheapest solution is a good surge protector. Make sure you get one that's rated higher than 1250 joules. That's the minimum you need to protect your computer. Look on the box to see what the rating is. If there is no joule rating, that surge protector is probably not going to serve your need. Most office supply stores carry surge protectors that are more than adequate. Also, make sure the surge protector has a shiny UL sticker on it. UL stands for Underwriter Laboratories, and they test different devices to make sure they live up to their advertised ratings. What else can you do? The best way to protect your computer, especially in winter, is to purchase an uninterruptible power supply, or UPS. These devices have a battery as well as a surge protector. If the power goes out, or browns out, which is when the power goes below 110 volts, the battery will supply your computer with power long enough for you to save your work and shut the computer down. All right, you're saying, I've looked at UPSs, but there are dozens to choose from. How do I know which is the right one? Well, you're in luck. In the past, you needed to know the consumption in watts of all the equipment you were going to hook up to the UPS. You had to add them together, and that would give you a number that equated to consumption in watts. You would then look for a UPS that had that number or higher. Now, most UPS boxes have a chart on the side showing you several different system and monitor choices and how long each would run with that UPS. Also, you can visit websites of different UPS manufacturers. Most of them have tools that will help you figure out what size UPS you need. Two notes for your new UPS. One, it will come with the battery unplugged and uncharged. You will need to open it up and hook up a wire before you can use it. And two, never, never plug a laser printer into a UPS. Laser printers draw way too much current for a UPS to handle. Inkjet printers are fine, however. This has been John Tracy with your GeekBit. Tune in Friday mornings for Geek...
At 10 o'clock every Friday morning for GeekSpeak. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue, and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. You're listening to GeekSpeak. Miles, Sean, Didi, John, and I are speaking with Ron Austin of Action Front Data Recovery. If you have questions or comments about data recovery technology, call 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. The email address is geeks@geekspeak.com. .org. Hi, Ron. Welcome back.
Hi, Lau.
Ron, we had a whole during the break, we chatted real quick about the geeks and I chatted real quick about different questions we have for you. So we're going to slaughter you with questions.
Okay, well, I'll do my best.
Sean?
One of the things I'm noticing is a trend that hard drives are becoming, of course, more inexpensive, larger. The technologies are just increasing. The spindle speeds. The gigabits per square inch, which is the way that...
You really got into what I call it Moore's Law for the hard drive industry. Moore's Law, if you remember, goes to the Intel processors that they double in power and at the same cost every 18 months. Well, drives follow kind of similar patterns.
Yeah, and it strikes me that hard drive manufacturers can't be making a lot of money. So it seems to me that the parts going into hard drives are going to be, maybe not the highest quality... I'm speculating here, And also, I'm thinking that warranties are being reduced from 3 years to 1 year. They want you to pay extra for that sort of thing. Are we going to see more failures moving forward with these 100 gig, 200 gig hard drives? I mean, you can buy these things at stores now for almost a dollar a meg, if not, you know.
A dollar a gig.
Yeah, a dollar a gig, excuse me. Sometimes even cheaper than that. And I'm just wondering, you know, people are going to be putting more and more data. And it's not, it's all going to become, you know, it's going to be valuable data, especially with people with video cameras. You know, they're doing their music.
Ron, do you have thoughts on this issue?
And well, I'm just wondering, what do you think? Because you must have a business perspective.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I have a few comments, and I've been around the drive industry for a long time in a lot of different guises, and you know, I think the reduction in cost has much more to do with you know, the economies of scale and the improvements in the technology than it does necessarily in the cost of the components going into it. I think that's always been you know, probably a minor part of it, and you know, there is a higher quality drive you can buy if you buy the SCSI product, SCSI product, as opposed to the ATA product, which most of us use in all our computers. However, the price point's quite a bit higher. The MTBF hours, the mean time between failure hours, you know, are holding fairly steady. It's somewhat of a theoretical number, but in general, the drives are fairly reliable. I mean, you'd get the odd series where, you know, they'll get a bad reputation for some reason or other, but you know, it just seems like they are mechanical devices, and they're really masterpieces of electromechanical engineering, and it's not surprising that they fail from time to time. And statistically, a small number of failures is numerically a lot of failures that, you know, that add up. Having said all that, I think what I would advise people to do is take advantage of those low prices. What I've done at home, after losing data myself and knowing better, you know, about backups and so forth, but never having the time to really back up and really feed a bunch of CDs into my machine or whatever, is I just simply went out and bought a second hard drive, and I set it up as a slave drive, put it in the machine. And I just do I just use the regular Windows backup, or sometimes even just the copy command to copy lots and lots of data back and forth. And at, you know, what is it, $100 now for a 60 gigabyte or something like that? So
yeah.
There's really no excuse not to have some kind of backup on your machine, and the inexpensiveness of the drives is a really good excuse to use drives for that.
So almost your recommendation really for people is to, when you buy a hard drive, buy two.
Buy two. When you buy a computer, that for that extra $100, put two in. Put in a good, you know, buy either the Norton Ghost or your own little copying routines, and keep it copied. If there's really important data, then you should take an offsite copy. Like, you should copy the most important stuff to tape or to CD and make, you know, take it to your brother-in-law's house or something like that. But in general, if you're like most of us, you know, just having that second drive there and using it on a regular basis, you know, should be enough. Of course, businesses are in a totally different position, and they really need to make some pretty significant investments in redundancy.
So Ron, something that I've been recommending to people is buy high-performance drives for your operating system, but for data backup, buy a slower drive. Instead of 7,200 RPM, maybe a 5,400 RPM.
If you can find one.
They know you can find them. Because they actually don't have, they're not spinning as fast, and the likelihood of them breaking down is going to be reduced.
Yeah, and I think they throw off a little less heat, too. I think you will find certain manufacturers are still producing, you know, the lower speed drives to hit a certain sweet spot in the, you know, the business out there. I think you know, the data recorder machines for TVs, I forget what they're called, but they're, you're allowing
set-top
you to record.
Boxes and TiVos. And
yeah. Mm-hmm. Those guys, I think, are trying to use the slower ones because of the heat issue and so forth. It's more
right.
of a heat issue than anything else.
Yeah.
And also, they only need a certain speed for recording and playing back video at the same time.
They're also quieter.
Yeah, exactly. Because bless you, you don't need fans. Now, there's got to be, you must have a big, big issue with storage. I mean, right now, the consumers don't have a good storage option other than hard drives that's inexpensive. Tape never really took off. I just don't see anything out there for storing data over a long period of time, past 3 to 5 years that hard drives last. And I'm wondering, what kind of media do you send data back to consumers once you've recovered the information? You've got all this data that you need to get back. What do you use?
Well, it really depends on the amount of data and the preferences of the customer. By default, I would say that if it's 2 or 3 gigabytes that's in question, we'll simply copy that to a series of CDs and send the CDs back to the customer. When it gets to be more than that, both for our own, well, for the customer's convenience and our own production efficiency, I guess, we actually recommend it go onto another hard drive. So we'll sell the consumer a hard drive at cost, or ask them to send in a good drive along with their problem drive, and we'll copy all that data to a drive. Some of the companies that we deal with want their data back on tape, for instance.
Right.
So that's really the three ways most of it goes back.
Well, let me ask about the data in general. Let's say someone has megs and megs of MP3s. Are you concerned whether they're legal copies or not?
Well, let me first of all say that people aren't paying, the kind of cost that it costs for data professional data recovery to retrieve MP3s. That's the kind of thing where they can go and download and so forth themselves. In general, we're not really concerned about the type of data. We try to maintain confidentiality of the customer's data. The times we would look at it would be to prove that that is actually workable. One of the things that we promise our customers, and I think we're fairly unique in this, is we give what's called a data guarantee. So the data has to be usable, and if you get the data back and it's not usable, then we'll redo the recovery or refund the fees or whatever in order to keep you happy. So in the process of doing that, we may peek into the data, but so far I guess we've been lucky. We haven't run into a lot of illegal data and haven't had to deal with that. Obviously, we're bound by local laws like anybody would be, and would have to deal with it if we came across that. But
what about a consumer that's going to come to you possibly because they've lost some very important documents? They also happen to have a whole bunch of pornography on their drive, and they're going, no way am I going to take this to data recovery place, so they know that I have. Do you get that kind of problem? Are consumers not going to because of that?
We haven't had to face it overtly. Obviously, as I mentioned before, we're bound by the laws in any particular location, and if we were to come across illegal content, and that would be basically child pornography and things like that, then we would be duty bound to report it. And I think that people really self censor themselves, like you mentioned. They're going to be pretty careful about if they're criminals and they're not totally dumb, they're going to be pretty careful about where they send their mm-hmm. stuff out to.
I was just wondering, it's sort of a funner question. What do you do with the spare parts or that you get from recovering hard drives? Does anyone have an art project going?
That's a good one. Well, first of all, depending on the customer's preferences, we will send the defective drives back to them. We do maintain an inventory of something like 16,000 different drives in various conditions, something like 6,000 unique models, in order to be able to cannibalize them for spare parts during recoveries. So
that's a bit of development cost.
Anything we get kind of goes into our collection, and we track it in a database, and we may need it again a month from now, or who knows, 5 years from now, after that's become totally obsolete and nobody can find it anymore.
Do you have those drives stored in multiple locations, multiple labs, or do you have a copy of all those drives in every lab?
Well, we keep a certain amount of inventory in every lab.
The common drives.
The most common ones are kept in every lab, and then the more obscure ones are probably wherever the last recovery was. We track it by database, and if somebody needs that, we'll ship it around to various labs to make sure that we've got it. Most of the time, we're able to service what we need right out of the local inventory.
So if you had a drive in and you know that you found out that the platters look good, you had to pull it apart, but the platters look good, but one of the heads is messed up. Do you actually take an old other copy drive and replace all the arm completely, or just the heads, or how do you go about doing
well,
that?
Well, you're getting a little more technical, and there's obviously people here that can answer that better, but I think I can give you a fairly good answer to that. We will always try and use the original arm and head assembly because of alignment problems if you go to a different one. So we would tend to try to clean the heads, repair the heads, and use the original one. Failing that, we'll go to a head stack or an arm and head assembly from an identical drive and try that.
Wow. Now, Sean, you were just mentioning micro drives. So I'll ask, Ron, do you handle micro drives?
Well, I'm really glad you asked. I think, as far as I know, we're the only recovery company that actually does. We were able to source the particular tool set that can open those. And, in fact, the picture you posted on your website today...
Geekspeak.org.
Yes, exactly. You pulled it with permission off of our website, and that's actually one of our technicians, the guy with magic fingers, who's working right on a microdrive. So we've done quite a lot of recoveries on those IBM microdrives.
And it fits in like the palm of your hand, these microdrives.
Well, yeah, you were mentioning it's about the size of a silver dollar. So it's very small. It's about an inch in diameter. And, you know, they're incredibly small. That's the biggest challenge on working with those ones.
We got an email from Ted. Gosh, do you guys read this too?
Yeah.
Miles, can you handle this?
Yeah, the question has to do with a Linux command line. It's using the program DD. He's saying if you write a whole bunch of zeros to the hard drive, can you wipe out the data? Is it possible to get the data you just removed? The answer is yes, you can get that data back. Hard drives keep a
hit.
Well, it just because you
but
write
a controversial
over.
Question, by
okay.
the way. Okay,
yeah, interview. Ron. What basically Ted's asking is, if he does, he wants to totally destroy the data on the drive. So he writes zeros to all the sector. I mean, every bit on the entire drive, and then somebody else takes that drive and sends it to you. Are you able to recover that data? The original.
Depending on how well it's been overwritten, I would say no. If it's been, there's layers and layers. If it's a good data erasure program that's really written a series of ones and zeros all over the drive and done it multiple times, I don't believe there's anybody in the world who can do it, commercial data recovery or even in the best FBI CIA lab.
And this is important because we're hearing about companies going under all the time and leaving very important data on the machines they leave behind or they sell off. Or if you're taking a drive and you actually need to get rid of the data because it's confidential, there's got to be some way to wipe it so that people like you can't recover it.
There are commercial data erasure programs. There's a company called Norman who's written one, and there's other ones available. And proper use of those programs, I believe, will erase the data permanently. Just doing a high-level format will not.
Well, the question as I was coming by was saying if you wrote a bunch of zeros once, I believe in the security community I've seen on many news groups, what they were talking about was writing random data, not just zeros, but ones and zeros, and doing it six times over the entire drive was the only way they were saying would be safe, even though that would be paranoia. But then again, if the data is so important, you don't want it to get into the wrong hands.
Well, in that case, I'd break the drive open and smash it. I mean, let's face it, that's going to make sure that nobody will ever get data from it.
Ron, that's a great suggestion. I'm going to quote you on that. We have Jeffrey from Los Gatos on line one. Jeffrey, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi there. When you mentioned that there was a patch, I went to my Windows update. I've got two machines, a 2000 and a 90, and a 98, and both of them offered up a 818529 June 2003 QM patch. Is that what we're talking about?
This is for the bugbear?
Yeah.
That should work. That's new enough that it's...
If you're already infected, it's not going to do anything.
Right.
I don't think I am.
Okay, then yeah, that's the one.
Okay.
You basically, if you go to Windows Update and run Windows Update, they should have the patch already out there because it's such a vulnerable.
Okay. And,
second question?
Yeah, second point was just an observation of mine. I figured out a long time ago that a second hard drive was a whole lot faster way to back up, but I worried about it being in the machine all the time, so I put it on one of those removable racks.
Mm-hmm.
And after I back up, I put it in my firebox.
Just don't drop it.
Well, that's right. But anyway, it's
that's a good practice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, so you have basic
it's
protection.
It's also
yeah.
offline. Should I become infected?
Right. Right.
And so.
Well, Jeff, thank you very much. Jeffrey, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, that does make sense. If you're gonna have, and actually, Ron, you mentioned earlier, if you're gonna use a hard drive as a second backup, you might want it on a second premises. That's normally why hard drives.
Yeah,
necessary.
That makes some sense. If you use a USB drive or a regular drive built into an external USB enclosure, then that gives you the portability and removability that you need. So you kind of got the best of all worlds then. It's gonna be a little more expensive than just a second drive inside your computer.
Right, Zoe from Monterey.
Hi, I wanted to know if
can you speak up, Zoe?
I'm sorry, is that better?
Yeah.
I wanted to know if hard drives have been reformatted accidentally. Is it possible to get the data off of it?
Great question, Ron.
I couldn't hear Zoe. Could you repeat it?
Oh, sure. I'll repeat it. The question is, if you reformat a hard drive, can you still get the data off of it?
It really kind of depends on the format. To my knowledge, there's kind of a regular high-level format, and then there's a low-level format. The low-level format should do what a data erasure program does, which is rewrite all the various sectors on the drive.
But you're not really going to normally run into a low-level format. It's going to take a long time.
Exactly.
So people normally do high-level formats.
All the high-level format does, it would be the equivalent of taking the index catalog in a library and burning it, but all the books would still be on the shelf. You just wouldn't be able to find them as easily.
So do you ever get situations where someone will ask you to recover the data on a drive like that?
All the time.
And are you able to do it normally?
Oh, normally it's just a matter of time and effort at that point in time. Often the files are very fragmented. I advise people to use a little program called Defrag on a regular basis, because that's what makes one of the things that can make a recovery expensive is when you're trying to unfragment or rebuild all those files. But if it's the file structure that's gone, but all the data is still there, then we can usually repair it and get pretty close to 100% recovery.
Zoe, did that answer your question?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. Miles, you have a question?
And on a side note, for folks out there, for defrag can many times make your computer run faster, so there's another reason to use it.
You're basically reorganizing.
It might even make your hard drive last longer, too, because it's not going to be thrashing around nearly as much after you do a defrag.
Unless you defrag all the time, which, of course, would be a lot of data. Hard drive use.
We should kind of maybe explain what this fragmentation.
Basically,
is.
Imagine a library. A library is a good example. A library with index card set, and you take the library and you move the books all over the place, but you make your index cards much more complicated. That's a defragmented, or that's a fragmented hard drive.
Well, also think of having each book doesn't necessarily have to come together. You may split the book into three books and
comes
put a
volumes.
Piece of the book in different places.
Right. So it's
the time it would take to walk around the library and put those books together.
If I can take a stab at that, think of your the most fragmented files we see are the email files, because you're always deleting emails all the time, and every time you delete that email or any file, it flags that area as being available or being empty. It's not actually been written over. The data is still there, but the next time the email program or another program needs space on the drive, it'll use that. So you end up with a Swiss cheese pattern on your drive with data written all over the place, with little
Correct.
Empty sectors all over the place, and defrag basically puts all those drags back files back into contiguous pieces.
Great. Well, thank you very much for that description. Do you have anything else you wanted to add before we call it a day?
Well, no, I just wanted to, thank you very much for the opportunity. I like to echo the comments at the beginning of the program. Backup is really the most important thing that anybody can do to protect themselves from data loss. However, even some of the people who back up go to read their backups and can't, and we do recoveries on backups as well. So no matter what your issue is, if you really need your data back, we recommend professional data recovery. And, of course, we think ActionFront's probably the best choice to do that. But thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Vice President of Marketing and Business Development at ActionFront Data Recovery Labs, www.actionfront.com. Ron Austin holds a BA in Computer Science from York University and graduated with distinction. Ron began his IT career as a programmer analyst, then moved into sales, marketing, eventually general management, getting many years' experience at the senior executive level of technology companies, including serving as president and CEO of Globella Corporation before it was sold to Tech Data Corporation. Ron, thank you very much for being on GeekSpeak.
Thanks, Lau.
You can learn more about data recovery. Ron actually has a couple great articles that are on ActionFront's site about what you should do to prepare for data recovery. Eventually, you'll probably have to deal with it if you have a computer. You can learn more about that at geekspeak.org and just look up today's show, which will be archived later today. This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. This morning, the geeks were Dee Dee Hubbard, Sean Cleveland, John Tracy, and Miles Elam. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you all for participating in GeekSpeak today. Thanks, geeks.
Oh, thank you.
Everyone chime in.
You're welcome.
And to those that called in, thank you very much for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without your input, it would just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that? We'll be back next week, 10 o'clock on Friday morning. Talk about backup solutions, how to back up your data, because I'm hoping today you're a little scared about data loss, so next week you'll learn how to do backups. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Otto, or on the web at kosp.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is Geek Speak.